Welcome back to this special Think Tank edition of Lung Cancer Update. Perhaps the most discussed 2006 ASCO presentation in lung cancer was the second presentation of data from a CALGB trial focusing on adjuvant chemotherapy for patients with stage 1B disease, as commented on by Dr. Edelman.
It's the only study that exclusively focused on the T2N0 stage 1B group. Remember that T2N0 is a heterogeneous group, defined both by size as well as involvement of the pleura. It includes everybody from 3 centimeters on up. So certainly we go into this knowing that the staging system was not handed down on Mount Sinai. It is not divinely inspired, and there are some issues, and that will come up in the analysis of this trial. These patients were resected, and then they either received an adjuvant chemotherapy, carbo-paclitaxel, or observation, which is, I think, the only appropriate study design at that time. And unfortunately, and I think this impacts on the depressing state of affairs in adjuvant therapy in lung cancer, is it took forever and a day. In an area where we've learned how many thousands upon thousands of patients have this disease, this trial, which started in 1996, I guess probably put its first patient on around 97, never really enrolled all the 500 patients that originally wanted to. And so Gary Strauss, when he presented this, showed that to one extent, the good part of this is you needed fewer patients because you had more time and the events were already accruing. So this was a reanalysis first presented in ASCO 2004. And at that time, the curves were clearly separated, and they still are clearly separated for the reasonable analysis. I mean, out at 8 years, they're not, but that's just an artifact of Kaplan-Meier, but still separated at all relevant points, except at the very beginning where you wouldn't expect things to have much influence. Disease-free survival, again, still quite clearly separated. The biggest problem is the overall survival is no longer statistically significant at 5 years, but remains statistically significant at 3 years, and the disease-free survival remains statistically significant. What is interesting, and so therefore the trial is now interpreted as, quote, negative, though still positive for disease-free survival, positive for 2 and 3 year overall survival. And what is interesting is, as we try to identify which populations may benefit from treatment, that what has emerged is a group that, not surprisingly, clearly, and this was a non-planned subgroup analysis, but fairly large numbers, that clearly the greater than 4 centimeter patients do very well or do better with chemotherapy, and it's statistically significant. And obviously less than 4 centimeters, they don't do so well. So the message for me from all of this is that these patients with smaller tumors are at less risk, and this doesn't seem to yet be a reasonable strategy for them. However, the larger tumors, and we've known this for quite a while, there's an ample amount of retrospective data that shows that the larger your tumor, it's continuous, it's not a dichotomous variable, and these patients probably would benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy.
In a survey question for this think tank, the faculty were virtually unanimous that patients with good performance status and stage 1B disease should be presented with the option of adjuvant chemotherapy, and Dr. Lynch began the discussion by commenting on the concept of relative risk reduction and the potential impact of treatment in lower-risk patients.
I believe strongly that similarly to colon cancer, similarly to breast cancer, I think our problem with stage 1 lung cancer is very much the way when I was a fellow with node negative breast cancer, we all kind of thought it probably worked. There wasn't any hard evidence that it worked, and we had to wait for larger trials to be able to show that that same relative risk reduction requires a larger number of patients to demonstrate a benefit. So,
and that doesn't mean that you use it. It just means that you would estimate that there would be benefit there.
And you advise a patient based on their particular risk profile what you think the potential beneficial outcome would be in that setting. And I think oncologists are doing that already in practice.
So how did you answer this question, 1A disease?
I hope I answered in between, because there is the occasional 1A patient that I do talk to about adjuvant chemotherapy.
And if a 1A patient says to you, I understand there's side effects, et cetera, but will this lower my already modest or low risk for recurrence?
I tell them I think it probably will, to the best of our ability to estimate.
One other follow-up to Marty. Another thing, looking at other tumors, oxaliplatin was approved for colon cancer, is now standard of care as adjuvant treatment. They have absolutely no survival data. It's all disease-free survival. Is disease-free survival enough in an adjuvant trial of lung cancer?
That hasn't been used yet. I think that would be certainly a reasonable thing to look at. I think that even if you're overall survival are similar, I mean, this is such a symptomatic disease, that would be a reasonable endpoint. I'd like to get back to the 1A thing. You know, if you asked me 6 months ago or a year ago, I would have probably agreed with Tom. There was the occasional 1A patient I would discuss this with. I think what I've learned is that the 1A patients, I used to say, well, if they were 2 centimeters and they had vascular invasion or something, and I got very nervous about those patients. The problem is that what we've learned from the 9633 update is that smaller tumors really didn't benefit, at least from what we can tell. So I think I'm a lot more conservative about that, and I put that I wouldn't do that. The problem is that this is a very heterogeneous disease. The breast cancer people learn this, and I think it's even more so in lung, and we can break it down on size. The fact that a 5-centimeter tumor is T2 and a 3-centimeter tumor is T2, and you know, for years there's been data that shows that those are higher risk patients.
Ed, can you talk a little bit about how you clinically approach decision about adjuvant chemotherapy, 1A, 1B, 2, and what agents or regimens do you use?
I think there's several issues, and certainly Harvey can chime in on this as well. Using the 1A, 1B arbitrary definition, we are neglecting that many times we are making diagnoses without full pathological staging. That's the first thing. We do not have sentinel lymph node biopsy in lung cancer. Sampling is not as good as full nodal dissection. So you call someone a 1A, 2-centimeter with a 1 lymph node resected, I don't think that's a 1A in my own opinion. So that automatically makes me want to treat a patient with adjuvant chemotherapy. I think we learned from the Japanese data that 2 centimeters was actually more prognostic in many more patients. I'm curious about this CLGB trial because for 2 years now, there have been oncologists out there using carboplatin in every stage of adjuvant therapy and calling this the pure trial, the 1B, the most homogenous. I never really liked this trial that much because it was small. It was going to be underpowered. We knew that because of the unfortunate accrual. But I'm just curious if this is really going to be a standard of care from CLGB now, a 4-plus centimeter, because that's the data that's being out there. And now I still hear physicians saying it still works for 3-year and other endpoints, surrogate endpoints, but the trial's negative.
No, it's not. Okay, the trial's not over. Okay, so let's be very clear about this. There are still, have not accrued the number of events that were pre-planned in any part of the analysis, so we don't know the answer to this. And there's primary endpoint. It's not like it's negative with a 0.995 hazard ratio, and then we're dissecting out and trying to find some group that has a benefit or not. Instead, we have, now it's what, 0.1 or something, or 0.08. And what if it's 0.051? Are you going to sit there and not give that? I mean, it's interesting that people who are going and based upon retrospective subgroup analyses are defining a standard of care one thing, and here you have a potentially cure, what is at best a palliative treatment, maybe life extending, and here we have a potential to increase cure. I think that I don't believe that we will define what I call a, quote, standard of care with total level one evidence. I agree with Jack on that with this because, unfortunately, the trial is a little bit on the small side. But let's remember something else also. YALT also did not finish. It's accrual. We've had a lousy result in that.
So what is the clinical implication, Ed? What do you do in your practice?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is that the standard now? Is that what CLGB is recommending, that 4-plus centimeter tumors?
No, that's not what we're recommending. That is absolutely
not. So what
not.
Is it then?
We do not have a statement like Allen and ECOG. The study is not over yet. And nowhere was this concluded that this represents a standard of care. What was presented was an analysis that because there is now difficulty in how to interpret this, where a few years ago this was, I think, pretty clear-cut, and now for one reason or another, it's not so clear-cut. The information has been presented, and I think this is an area where one can, in fact, dissect this out and discuss it with a patient because you're just uncertain, and we may never have an answer.
Mark, there are two issues. Has this really changed how you talk to patients before ASCO and after ASCO? I don't think it has for me personally. And secondly, is it going to change the design of the next trial from ECOG? Based on this, are you going to exclude 1B patients?
Alan?
There was an interesting article in the New England Journal of Medicine about the concept of subset analysis in general and how we overuse and abuse it. So there have been a number of randomized studies with cisplatin-based therapy that overall were positive studies, including 1B patients, that some people have chosen to look at the subsets for 1Bs and says, oh, but it's negative for 1Bs, we shouldn't use it. Then we get to the 1B for CLGB, where it's overall, quote, negative, although I personally think that in my mind, it shows what we expected, an insufficiently powered study that's numerically better. But the subset is positive for 4 centimeters. So I personally think adjuvant therapy is proven for 1B through 3A with cisplatin-based therapy. I don't think there's any question. That's what the studies have shown. And my bias is that for that 1B, for the CLGB, I'm not going to not treat a 1B because of that study. You look at those curves, I mean, I'd take those curves any day of the week for any oncology study with the right number of patients. But I use cisplatin, and that's where 1505, which was set to go with three cisplatins, including docetaxel, gem, and vinorelbin, is going to change. What we're left with, and I think it's going to be a problem, is we are now going to have a statistically perfect study with just three cisplatin-based arms, possibly two, that will not accrue. And in about 2 to 3 years, we'll have to amend it and include Taxol Carbo. And we're going to include the 1Bs, and we are going to cut it off at 4 centimeters. That would be 4 centimeters or greater. And I think that, to me, and I argued against that personally, because I think that it's an abuse of the subset analyses along the way. But this has held discussions with CTEP and the NCI, the FDA.
Ed, what about selection of adjuvant chemo?
Yeah, and that's why I brought that up with Alan, because, again, what I'm hearing from the community is this is what the impact of CLGB 9633 was, is that carbotaxol is acceptable. And ironically, we have two visiting doctors from Brazil who are observing in our clinics, and one asked me just yesterday, so the standard of care in the U.S. is carbotaxol, right? I said, well, yes, more than 50% of the people use it. And I said, why would you choose carbotaxol? And he goes, well, isn't that an approved regimen? And I said, well, why don't you do a PubMed search and show me the data that would justify carbotaxol and the dose that you would choose of Taxol? And this is during my clinic, so 4 hours later, we had dissected how 250 per meter squared was as good as 135 per meter squared 24 hour, but had too many side effects. So the 135 became the standard of care of a 24 hour. Then we showed a 175 versus 225, which seemed to show it was pretty similar, but actually by the data, 225 seemed a little better than 175. And then no one uses 225, so everybody uses 200. And none of that's approved. And it was very interesting. And I said, this is what's happened is that we've digressed from these regimens of where the approval trials were to regimens that we don't know are optimal or suboptimal. I think that begs the carbotaxol question with the study, and that's why it comes up. And so I think cisplatin is the key in adjuvant. And I think you can probably pair it with a number of different drugs to show benefit.
So when these two Brazilian visitors ask you, what are you going to use, what do you use?
I will talk to patients and I'll say, if you go by the data, that body of evidence out there, it's cisvinorelbine. But I also tell them that I'll use cis-docetaxel quite a bit based on the 326 study that Frank Vasella presented, because in the metastatic setting, it was similar in efficacy but had better side effects, better quality of life.
And so how do you decide between those two?
Oh, I usually go with docetaxel on most of those. The vinorelbine requires a central line to administer because it's a vesicant. So,
Mark?
Yeah, a couple comments. One is, I do think cis is a better drug. Cis is a more difficult drug to give in this population. Secondly, it's hard for me to go from these esoteric discussions about whether exon 19 is better than exon 21 and then talk in the adjuvant setting about, is cis better than carbo? You know, I wish 3 years ago at CLGB, I said, can't we do a carbo versus cis adjuvant trial? Just get it over with. The endpoint is death at 3 to 5, whatever you want to pick. And you know, one or the other. We are going to continue because we aren't going to do this. We're going to ask the bevacizumab question. Hopefully someone outside the U.S. will do a trial of carbo, you pick the second drug, versus six, you pick the second drug, and we'll find out in the adjuvant setting what is best.
What regimen are you utilizing in general off protocol?
Well, I agree with what Ed said. When I look at the stage four, I try to give cis. I think the second drug, we have no evidence, but I tend to use gem or taxane-based therapies. Problem is that a lot of patients that I see postoperatively aren't great cis candidates, and I think getting some therapy in, some exposure,
absolutely,
even if it's carbo,
absolutely,
is important.
And what do you pair it with?
When I use carbo, I use Taxol.
Rogério, how do you approach these patients?
So, you know, I think the CLGB trial had a great impact on my practice. So up until this past ASCO, I discussed with patients and colleagues and the initial analysis of the CLGB trial, and I consider that level one evidence. And I discussed with several members of our community who called for questions and recommendations that in 1B patients, I felt very comfortable using carboplatin paclitaxel. Well, that has changed since the updated analysis. I still recommend that most 1B patients receive adjuvant chemo However, whenever possible, I use a cisplatin-based regimen.
Paired with what?
Usually docetaxel. Not always, necessarily, but usually docetaxel. I've used gemcitabine once in a while, despite the absence of data. People who were very adamant about hair loss and things of that nature. And if I see a patient, as Mark said, who is clearly not a good candidate for cisplatin, then I will use carbo, but with a much lower level of confidence, I think, than I had up until ASCO. I do want to say that this 4-centimeter business is shocking to me, that the NCI and other regulatory agencies would take that subset analysis and include that in a subsequent prospective phase
You're
3
surprised?
Trial. I am shocked. I'm absolutely shocked.
It's ridiculous.
I want to get actually Harvey's take on this from the non-medical oncology world, but just one follow-up question. Why do you generally prefer docetaxel in terms of paclitaxel?
No, if I use it with carbo, cis-paclitaxel is not a regimen that I've used. I think most people here don't use cis-paclitaxel. So when I use cis, I use docetaxel. If I use carbo, I can use paclitaxel. There's no science behind it. It's just a level of comfort.
Harvey, what are your thoughts?
Well, for the patients who clearly qualify from the previous level one evidence, and I'm not including the CalGB trials level one evidence, then at our institution, which is that smallish institution that's somewhere on the east side in New York, is cis docetaxel. And in the patient who can't tolerate cis, to look at carbo. But as a surgeon, if we move back or earlier, I mean, I examine the pathology report much more carefully than I used to. I mean, there are certain things that I look for and I don't have answers for yet. Number one, lymphovascular invasion is really a buzzword for me at this point. So if I have a tumor of any size that has lymphovascular invasion and I'll be thinking about what the SUV was on the PET scan at the same time to see what the deal was, then at conference, I'm saying this patient is a 1A or 1B, but has this. What about that Korean data? What about that we're worried about lymphovascular invasion? Then we'll get into the discussion, should this patient get adjuvant therapy in that situation? At least I will get the patient to my medical oncologist to discuss this. The things I don't understand, though, is the more weird stuff like visceral pleural invasion and where that comes in and whether that's so important or as much as lymphovascular invasion.
It's interesting because, you know, it wasn't presented there, but my understanding is actually that where you had this like 2-centimeter tumor touching the pleura, which would have been included under this definition of this, that those lines were pretty superimposable. And I agree. I think that all the patients should have been included within the ECOG study.
Mark?
Yeah, I want to ask Harvey, because one of the most common questions that I get when I talk about lung cancer to community physicians is, how do you get our surgeons to do mediastinoscopy or to do mediastinal dissections or sampling? Because we are seeing patients for adjuvant therapy in which you look at the path report in the operative note and you don't get the sense that the surgeon realized there is a mediastinum in the patient.
I think we're in a transition period. I mean, I think that our cardiac friends have led us to this transition period, which is good. And it's our cardiac friends on the cardiology side, although I have good cardiac surgeon friends now. What's happening is that we are getting a different population of thoracic surgeons. Now, our older thoracic surgeons, I guess I'm included, have led the way, but now the newer thoracic surgeons realize the importance of aggressive 10 to 15 minute doing this in the operating room, and it's being beat into them at the centers. That's why I answered your question that at the centers where the idea of doing a mediastinal lymph node dissection is powered into these people until we get the data from ECOSOG that really says it makes a difference or not, for your information about what you need, it's independent. A sampling can be done and maybe get some information, but it's useless if you see just one or two nodes. You need to know that there was a full dissection and that at least you can look back and see that. So I think that it's going to change. I think that what's happening is that with the training of new thoracic surgeons, that's going to be less of a problem. And the importance is to be able to hire those people in high-profile communities so that they set the standard. But the other thing that's important is that the thoracic surgeon cannot be looked at as competition to the pulmonologist. In other words, with the technologies that are now happening that may decrease mediastinoscopies, you need to have that technology extending both to the pulmonologist and to the thoracic surgeons to do endobronchial ultrasound or whatever, so you're going to be able to get what you need, so you're not going to miss the opportunity that the pulmonologist doesn't do it, a thoracic surgeon will do it. And that's why training programs now for thoracic surgery need to incorporate new technologies, not only on the molecular side, but on the technical side, so that thoracic surgeons can provide you that service too.
The next issue related to the use of chemotherapy, both in the adjuvant and metastatic settings in elderly patients, has commented on by Dr. Lilienbaum.
So in patients with advanced disease, I think we have enough retrospective data that can be applied to our practice, really. I think patients who have good performance status and no major comorbidities can probably be treated like younger patients and seem to derive the same type of benefit, perhaps with a slight increase in certain specific toxicities. I think that applies mostly to patients who are 70 to 79, if you use the cutoff of 70 years of age for elderly. I don't know about patients who are 80 or above 80, the so-called octogenarians. These patients seem to have more problems in terms of toxicity, and there's also questions about the efficacy of chemo, or at least combination chemotherapy in this subset. I think we need to look at the 80-plus population a lot more carefully than we have so far, because this is a rapidly growing subset in the demographics in the United States. So I think we should be comfortable using the same regimens that we use for elderly patients that we use for younger patients. I prefer to use carboplatin-based regimens in this population, just like I do for younger patients in metastatic setting. In the adjuvant setting, I think that becomes a little bit of a problem because, as we discussed here before, if we think that cisplatin is a better analog to be used in the adjuvant setting, then this may represent an issue for some elderly patients, particularly those who have significant comorbidities. So it goes back to the point that I think Mark made before and others, which is we should try to use cisplatin-based doublets in the adjuvant setting whenever possible, but in certain patients, we should be able to compromise and use carboplatin if cisplatin poses a big threat.
Alan, what do we know about bevacizumab in the older patients?
We haven't broken it down yet by age in the study. We haven't looked at the results based on age. But of course, there were no limits based on age. But if it's similar to previous ECOG studies, there'd be about 20-25% over the age of 65 and probably less than 10% over the age of 75. And rarely anybody over 80, typically.
How do you approach adjuvant therapy and also first-line metastatic disease in patients in their 70s?
In the metastatic setting, more often in that age group would be carboplatin-based regimen, either GEM or paclitaxel.
With Bev?
Yeah. To tell you the truth, I haven't had too many. I just did start, actually, a gentleman who's in his mid-70s on paclitaxel, carbo, and bevacizumab.
And what kind of prior history would make you, other than the ECOG 4599, would make you maybe hesitate more in the elderly, or do you just use the same criteria?
I agree with Rogerio. I'm a little leery of the 80 and over. I just don't think we have very many folks on those studies that are that age. If they were very, very fit, I would consider putting them on, but I'd be very cautious. I probably restrict it to a PS0, someone who's really fit at that age bracket. Adjuvant therapy, again, I tend to treat the elderly irrespective of age, just performance status, but I'm more cautious about performance status as they get over the age of 75.
Mark, patients in their 70s, adjuvant therapy and first-line metastatic disease.
Yeah, I tend not to use age as the criteria. To me, it's all about comorbid illness and also patient preference too. But I don't let age change my plan of care. And I think the data supports that too, that they seem to do just as well and have a little bit more toxicity, but there's never been any compelling analysis to say that the toxicity is substantially worse.
Again, Bev, first-line metastatic disease, patients in their 70s, use it?
I would use it.
Tom, we had actually Peter Ravden of Adjuvant Online fame at last year's think tank just to sort of stir things up because this is a model which predicts benefits of adjuvant therapy. One of the interesting things about that model is it factors in death from other causes, and that based on age, as you go from 70 to 75 or 80, you really start to see a steep decrease in the actual benefits statistically of chemotherapy. What do you think about that kind of approach in lung cancer? Does that make sense, or is comorbidity such a dominant issue in lung cancer that it doesn't?
I think what drives my use in elderly patients is really their functional status. And while I agree with Mark's comments that age is independent, it's very rare. I have not treated anybody over 80 with adjuvant therapy because I usually find a reason not to treat somebody over 80 with adjuvant therapy. Not because I don't believe in it, but because when I evaluate the patient, I find something that makes me concerned about doing it. So I do think that point about competing causes of mortality is valid, but I think it's reflected in someone's functional status. If you show me a 79-year-old who's got no coronary disease, no cerebral vascular disease, who's got a stage 2 lung cancer, I would certainly consider it. I just haven't found that patient yet.
Vince, 79-year-old who's a non-smoker in terms of her erlotinib, I can tell you that in breast cancer, that we had a 96-year-old woman presented at our Meet the Professor breast session. There you have the option of an aromatase inhibitor, so I think the issue of toxicity comes in. So what about erlotinib in this situation?
Well, and the flip side is that these people probably do have a more protracted natural history of their disease, so she probably has a better overall prognosis. I think it would be an individualized discussion, and depending on the risk of the tumor, a 3A, where I thought she might have a decent chance of it coming back in the next year or two, might be more inclined to offer it certainly than a 1B.
Again, first-line metastatic disease, any concerns about Bev and this patient in their 70s?
I think it's just harder to find these patients without contraindications as one gets older. Just like as you move through lines of therapy, it's harder for people to remain eligible for these drugs.
What is it that brings in contraindications when they get older? Performance status?
No, am I more likely to have had a recent CVA or an MI or be on anticoagulation for something for AFib?
Creatinine elevation. Hearing is the biggie.
I've also found that I've treated a 79-year-old for adjuvant, actually just extremely high risk based on the pathology features, and not without some reservations. What I found was that chemo can be a great equalizer in making a great performance status patient much closer to the typical 79-year-olds I see.
Ed?
So I think we've had a really nice discussion on adjuvant so far, and I just am here to stir the pot a little bit and make us think about all these little issues that are coming up, and hopefully it will lead to some change with the wide distribution you have, Neil, with your audience. I like using breast cancer as an analogy, and Neil, you brought this up earlier, in that are we going to become breast cancer? And that's the key, and I think we're probably at least a decade behind. The NSABP was mentioned, and they've been able to organize themselves very nicely in how they accrue to trials. They have a risk model, most importantly, and we don't have a risk model yet. We're trying to develop one. But then certainly adjuvant therapy has helped, and they are able to target their adjuvant therapy appropriately, and also big trials. They are very well organized. They can accrue to large numbers and answer these questions. I always start by telling a patient if they have a stage 1A, no matter what stage they are, it's not 100% survival at 5 years. It's not 90, maybe 80-ish, depending on where you are. And so, again, we have a lot of room to work with here. So some of the issues for adjuvant therapy was how to best stage a patient, because we're now drawing these lines. We won't treat stage 1s, or we would be less inclined to. We would treat stage 1Bs and maybe 2s and 3s, definitely. Which regimen is appropriate? How many cycles is appropriate? How long after surgery? We haven't discussed if you can wait 90 days, 80 days, 60 days, 40 days. Use of radiation. And then obviously, do we treat all the stages equally? So really talking about staging, I think PET CT really adds quite a bit, I think, for mediastinal evaluation. But I've had 5 cases this year of a negative PET and positive nodal dissection. And so really, that's important. The MRI also in stage 1, I think, is also something that a few years ago was a little more controversial. We do it in our patients. I think it's important to stage them there as well. And of course, this question of sampling versus dissection. If you have a sampling that's very good and you have a surgeon that inspects all of the lymph node groups, that should be adequate. But we prefer a full mediastinal dissection, obviously, to get an accurate staging. What are the approved FDA regimens for non-small cell? Nobody uses these regimens, obviously, in the metastatic setting. Bevacizumab is coming. We have to remind ourselves, if we're talking about benefits of 1, 2, 3%, does it matter if we use a different dose or a different schedule based on what's approved? And I know we have a lot of studies that are underpowered that show similarities, but are they truly non-inferiority, and are they truly going to tell us whether it makes a difference? There seems to be a benefit, and I think most of us accept that there is a benefit of chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting. Clearly, when you look at subsets of data, especially in the stage 1s, there doesn't appear to be much benefit. The BR10 was mostly a stage 2 study with cisvinorelbine and obviously did show a benefit. And then, of course, the CLGB study, showing that certainly there is a trend toward benefit with chemotherapy, but again, which patient in that study is defined as the better one to use. I think the 4-centimeter subset is not something that I would apply. I had been previously applying the 2-centimeter subset from the Japanese data, and I was giving carbo in my stage 1s based on this data. I have now rethought that as well and have given cis more often. And of course, the ANITA data that was presented last year at ASCO, showing that in 840 patients, there was a benefit overall with chemotherapy, but in the 5-year survival stage 1s, no difference in 5-year survival. So we do have data to suggest that other biologic therapies have worked. We've talked at length about Tarceva this morning, that it does have a benefit similar to chemotherapy in the second-line setting. Certainly this trial was second and third line and showed a 2-month advantage. Based on what I'm hearing today, it sounds like people would be more encouraged to enroll into this study, which is the adjuvant Tarceva study versus the bevacizumab study. Now, I'll just leave it like that, but this will be a study looking at stage 1B through 3A. You're able to use any 4 cycles of a platinum-based doublet. You will then be tested with your tissue to be either IHC positive or FISH positive, and if you are positive on either aspect, you will be enrolled into Tarceva or placebo, and if you're a double negative, then you won't. So it is trying to select patients, maybe to enrich a population to show a difference. It is going to be tough to show a benefit with this type of situation now as we go past chemotherapy and now into these biologic therapies.
Ed, did you say it was mutation positive? Or what was
They're using FISH and IHC.
FISH and okay. Or non-smokers.
Well, they're going to stratify on non-smokers, correct. The 1505 trial, and this is a moving target, as we've all heard. This is obviously going to change, but this is obviously the accepted intergroup study to move forward. I think it's important for everybody to be on the same page on this study so that it can accrue. So I think there needs to be a consensus on this. Obviously, this is an important trial to answer from a standpoint of non-small cell lung cancer. The treatment plan, again, is it sounds like there will only be cis-based regimens, and then you'll get Avastin for a year after completing the chemotherapy. So this is going to be challenging. We are going to have to really try and tease out a difference here by adding different regimens into lung cancer. Which regimen is appropriate? Well, cisvinorelbine was discussed, and Mark talked about that data. But if you extrapolate some of the data from metastatic, maybe cisdocetaxel is a nice regimen to use. And we do prefer these newer agents, whether it also be gemcitabine or others. How many cycles and how long after surgery? Well, 3 to 4 cycles, 45 to 60. Are we going to go up to 12 weeks? It's expanding now. Use of radiation, not standard. That's a judgment call, especially on upstaging. And should we treat all stages equally? I'll leave that as a big maybe. So with that, I'll close. Thank you.
In colon cancer, NSABP-C08, which compares FOLFOX alone or with bevacizumab, has almost completed accrual in just 2 years, and in both breast and lung cancer, clinical trial groups are scrambling around to launch major adjuvant trials evaluating bevacizumab. Dr. Lynch commented on the logistic challenge of this endeavor in lung cancer.
I think this is going to be a really tough trial to do. The reason to do it is that we finally have a regimen that improves outcome in stage 4 disease, and it makes great sense to want to see that work in earlier stage disease. But I can tell you our experience with 3 large Harvard hospitals that see over 1,000 lung cancers a year and operate on about 700, 800 early stage lung cancers a year between the MGH, the Brigham, and the BI, we have put 4 patients in 2 years on this study. And that's with no randomization to worry about. That's a single-arm study of carbo-tax-bev. The biggest reason people say, well, he had a heart attack once, or he had angina once, or he is on Fragmin, or the surgery took 9 to 10 weeks to recover from. It's been incredibly hard. And then now, on top of this, Alan, after seeing the 15 deaths in the group that got carbo-tax-bevacizumab, I think you're going to find a lot of other docs saying, oof, there's increased risk of death. I don't really want to give it to a great risk person. And our group has never shown discipline in doing randomized trials in the adjuvant setting. It's going to be very difficult.
So the problem is the eligibility criteria?
The problem is the eligibility criteria and the fact that as Bev has been developed during this 2-year period, there was that whole issue around with the colon cancer, with the increased strokes and heart attacks, the fact that all the consent forms at Harvard have to say there's a risk of stroke, a risk of blindness, a risk of bleeding to death. It's a very challenging and difficult study to sell to patients, which is shocking because you would think that something that improves survival in stage 4 disease makes great sense to look at in the adjuvant setting.
What's the solution?
I don't know. I hear from the group. I don't know.
Rogerio?
Up until this discussion today, I actually thought this trial would accrue very quickly because it's the most logical step.
Of course it is.
And you have the regimen in the metastatic setting. You bring into the adjuvant setting now that you have proof of principle the adjuvant chemo works. So I was actually very optimistic. And myself, I thought, gee, I'm going to put 30-some patients in this trial just ourselves. I'm a little distraught by what's happening with the chemo regimens and the 1B patients. And I think that may actually taint the trial a little bit. But the lesson from previous studies is quite obvious. You make it as simple as you can. You know, one simple question, give people choices, and that's it.
Roy Kukura said it, I think, very well. It's the obvious next step, and I don't disagree with that. It looks like it's the most active stage four regimen, and so then let's bring it forward. But maybe there's a little bit too much emphasis on what's the next step, doing a trial in the group, doing a big randomized trial. And I still worry we don't know exactly how this regimen is working, why it's working. We're only giving the Avastin for 1 year. Are we really killing all the tumor cells, or is the reason why patients will be cured or survive longer because we're maintaining dormant tumor? In that case, one would want to continue for a lifetime. Perhaps we should understand who to select and maybe use an oral agent. I actually think the trial in a selected group of patients with Tarceva makes a lot of sense. Again, that trial will allow us to select a group of patients. So I think that it does make sense. I think accrual is going to be difficult. I think the toxicity issues are complicated. But we're going to this big phase 3 trial. I really think we have to take light of the fact we have a benefit in lung cancer. It's reasonable. It is somewhat small. And now we need to figure out how to optimize which patients to treat.
Marty? I mean, I'm more optimistic about it. I mean, the colon cancer people have all the same, you know, the drug isn't any less toxic there. It may even, in fact, be more toxic in many respects with perforations in colon cancer. They don't have a problem with that. I think the people who could be most discouraging are us. So I'm going to put in my two cents, which is I was certainly skeptical based upon, you know, what I knew of the toxicity 5 years ago. Would Allen's trial be positive? And I still owe him dinner. And I'll be happy to pay up. And I think the fact is we have a clear signal. This is something that improved survival, albeit in a somewhat selective population, but that's the population in the adjuvant setting. To get into the adjuvant setting, you have to have had surgery, which means that you have better cardiovascular function, you have better pulmonary function. These are healthier patients prima facie. And so this is the right study to be done. It's the right time to do it. I think that the trade-off is acceptable. The benefits of chemotherapy in non-small cell lung cancer in the adjuvant setting are every bit as good, if not better, than they are in breast cancer or colon cancer. And now we have a drug that clearly works in the advanced stages. And the toxicity is a little bit elevated, but this is most likely in the poorer performance status patients, which I don't think will be there as much. So I think we need to be enthusiastic and press this trial and get it done and have an answer. Roy's right. There will be many, many questions that it won't answer, but that never stopped anybody else. Every trial that's been there in breast and colon in the adjuvant setting, there's always been some group not included or some group that was included, which you had a question. I mean, they're still arguing about stage 2 colon cancer patients. So, yeah, that's interesting, but really the bottom line is we have a drug that works. We can figure out why it works later on. Right now, let's show if we can cure a few more patients.